There were kids he knew visiting relatives. Kids he knew who were off on vacations at Disneyland in California or on Cape Cod or, in the case of one chum, an unimaginably distant-sounding place with the queer but somehow evocative name of Kestat. There were kids at church camp, kids at scout camp, kids at rich kid camps where you could learn to swim and play golf, camps where you learned to say, "Hey, good one," instead of "fuck you" when your opponent got a killer serve past you at tennis. Kids whose parents had simply taken them away. Bill could understand that. He knew some kids who wanted to go away, frightened by the boogeyman stalking Derry this summer, but suspected there were more parents frightened by that boogeyman. People who had planned to take their vacations at home suddenly decided to go away. Kestat. Was that in Sweden? Argentina? Spain? Instead. It was a little like the polio scare of 1956, when four kids who went swimming in the O'Brien Memorial Pool had gotten the disease. Grown-ups, a word absolutely synonymous in Bill's mind with mothers and fathers, had decided then, as now, that away was better, safer. Anyone able to clear out had cleared. Bill understood away, and he could muse over a word of such fabulous wonder as Kestat. But wonder was cold comfort compared with desire. Kestat was away. Derry was desire. And none of us have gone away, he thought, watching as Ben and Mike pounded used nails out of used boards, as Eddie strolled off into the bushes to take a whiz. You had to go as soon as you could in order to avoid seriously straining your bladder, he told Bill once, but you also had to watch out for poison ivy, because who needed a case of that on your pecker? We're all here in Derry. No camp, no relatives, no vacations, no away. All right here, present and accounted for. There's a door down there, Eddie said, zipping his fly as he came back. Hope you shook off, Eds, Richie said. If you don't shake off each time, you can get cancer. My mom told me so. Eddie looked startled, thinly worried, and then saw Richie's grin. He withered him, or tried to, with a baby's must-play look, and then said, it was too big for us to carry, but Bill said if all of us went down, we could get it up here. Of course, you can never shake off completely, Richie went on. You want to know what a wise man once told me, Eds? No, Eddie said, and I don't want you to call me Eds anymore, Richie. I mean, I'm sincere. I don't call you Dick, as in, you got any gum on your dick? So I don't see why... This wise man, Richie said, told me this. No matter how much you squirm and dance, the last two drops go in your pants. And that's why there's so much cancer in the world, Eddie, my love. The reason there's so much cancer in the world is because nerds like you and Beverly Marsh smoke cigarettes, Eddie said. Beverly is not a nerd, Ben said in a forbidding voice. You just watch what you say, trash mouth. Beep, beep, you guys, Bill said absently. And speaking of Beverly, she's pretty strong. She could help get that to door. Ben asked what kind of door it was. Mahogany, I think. Somebody threw out a mahogany door? Ben asked, surprised but not unbelieving. People throw out everything, Mike said. That dump, it kills me to go down there. I mean, it kills me. Yeah, Ben agreed. A lot of that stuff could be fixed up easy. And there are people in China and South America with nothing. That's what my mother says. There's people with nothing right here in Maine, Sonny Jim, Richie said grimly. Well, what's this? Bill asked, noticing the album Mike had brought. Mike told him, saying he would show them the picture of the clown when Stan and Beverly got back with the hinges. Bill and Richie exchanged a look. What's wrong? Mike asked. Is it what happened in your brother's room, Bill? Yeah, Bill said, and would say no more. They took turns working on the hole until Stan and Beverly came back, each with a brown paper bag containing hinges. As Mike talked, Ben sat cross-legged, tailor fashion, and made glassless windows that would swing open and shut in two of the long boards. Perhaps only Bill noticed how quickly and easily his fingers moved, how adept and knowing they were, like surgeon's fingers. Bill admired that. Some of these pictures go back 100 years, my dad said, Mike told them, holding the album on his lap. He gets them at those sales people have in their yards and at second-hand shops. Sometimes he buys them or trades other collectors for them. Some of them are stereoscopes. There's two of them just the same on a long card, and when you look at them through this thing like binoculars, it looks like one picture, only in 3D, like House of Wax or The Creature from the Black Lagoon. "Why does he like all that stuff?" Beverly asked. She was wearing ordinary Levi's, but she had done something amusing to the cuffs, blousing them out with a bright paisley material for the final 4 inches so that they looked like pants out of some sailor's whimsy. "Yeah," Eddie said. "Most of the time, Derry's pretty boring." "Well, I don't know for sure, but I think it's because he wasn't born here," Mike said diffidently. "It's like, I don't know, like it's all new to him. Or like, you know, if you came in during the middle of a movie."
Sure.
"You'd want to see this to start," Bill said. "Yeah," Mike said. "There's a lot of history lying around in Derry. I kind of like it. And I think some of it has to do with this thing, this it, if you want to call it that." He looked at Bill, and Bill nodded, his eyes thoughtful. "So I was looking through it after the 4th of July parade because I knew I'd seen that clown before. I knew it. And look." He opened the book, thumbed through it, then handed it to Ben, who was sitting on his right.
Don't touch the pages, Bill said.
And there was such urgency in his voice that they all jumped. He had fisted the hand he had cut reaching into Georgie's album, Richie saw, fisted it into a tight, protective knot.
"Bill's right," Richie said, and that subdued, totally un-Richie-like voice was a powerful convincer. "Be careful. It's like Stan said. If we saw it happen, you guys could see it happen, too."
"Feel it," Bill added grimly. The album went from hand to hand, each of them holding the book gingerly by the edges as if it were old dynamite sweating big beads of nitro. It came back to Mike. He opened it to one of the first pages.
"Daddy says there's no way to date that one, but it's probably from the early or mid-1700s, Mike said. "He repaired a guy's bandsaw for a box of old books and pictures. That was one of them. He says it might be worth $40 or even more."
The picture was a woodcut, the size of a large postcard. When Bill's turn came to look at it, he was relieved to see that Mike's father had the kind of album where the pictures were under a protective plastic sheet. He looked fascinated, and he thought,
"There, I am seeing him, or it, really seeing. That's the face of the enemy."
The picture showed a funny fellow juggling oversized bowling pins in the middle of a muddy street. There were a few houses on either side of the street, and a few huts that Bill guessed were stores or trading posts, or whatever they called them back then. It didn't look like Derry at all, except for the canal. It was there, neatly cobbled on both sides. In the upper background, Bill could see a team of mules on a towpath dragging a barge. There was a group of maybe half a dozen kids gathered around the funny fellow. One of them was wearing a pastoral straw hat. Another had a hoop and a stick to roll it with. Not the sort of stick that would come with the hoop that you bought today in a Woolworth's. It was a branch from a tree. Bill could see the bare knobs on it where smaller branches had been lopped off with a knife or a hatchet.
That baby wasn't made in Taiwan or Korea, he thought, fascinated by this boy who could have been him if he'd been born 4 or 5 generations before.
The funny fellow had a huge grin on his face. He wore no makeup, except to Bill his whole face looked like makeup. But he was bald except for 2 tufts of hair that stuck up like horns over his ears, and Bill had no trouble recognizing their clown.
200 years ago or more, he thought,
and felt a crazy surge of terror, anger, and excitement rush through him. 27 years later, sitting in the Derry Public Library and remembering his first look into Mike's father's album, he realized he had felt the way a hunter might feel, coming upon the first fresh spoor of an old killer tiger.
200 years ago. That long, and only God knows how much longer.
This led him to wonder just how long the spirit of Pennywise had been here in Derry. But he found that was a thought he did not really want to pursue.
"Gimme, Bill," Richie was saying,
but Bill held the album a moment longer, staring fixedly at the woodcut, sure it would begin to move. The bowling pins, if that's what they were, which the funny fellow was juggling, would rise and fall, the kids would laugh and applaud. Except maybe they wouldn't all laugh and applaud. Some of them might scream and run instead. The mule team pulling the barge would move beyond the borders of the picture. It didn't happen, and he passed the book on to Richie. When the album came back to Mike, he turned some more pages, hunting.
"Here," he said. "This one is from 1856, 4 years before Lincoln was elected president."
The book went around again. This was a color picture,
a sort of cartoon which showed a bunch of drunks standing in front of a saloon while a fat politician with mutton chop whiskers declaimed from a board that had been set between two hogsheads. He held a foamy pitcher of beer in one hand. The board upon which he stood was considerably bowed with his weight. Some distance off, a group of bonneted women were looking at this show of mingled buffoonery and intemperance with disgust. The caption below the picture read, "Politics in Derry is thirsty work, says Senator Garner." "Daddy says pictures like this were really popular for about 20 years before the Civil War," Mike said. "They called them fool cards, and people used to send them to each other. They were like some of the jokes in Mad, I guess."
Satire, Bill said.
"Yeah," Mike said. "But now look down in the corner of this one." The picture was like Mad in another way. It had as many details and little side jokes as a big Mort Drucker panel in a Mad Magazine movie takeoff. There was a grinning fat man pouring a glass of beer down a spotted dog's throat. There was a woman who had fallen on her prat in a mud puddle. There were two street urchins slyly sticking sulfur-headed matches into the soles of a prosperous-looking businessman's shoes, and a girl swinging from her heels in an elm tree so that her underpants showed. But despite this bewildering intaglio of detail, none of them really needed Mike to point the clown out. Dressed in a loud-checked, vest-busting drummer's suit, he was playing the shell game with a bunch of drunken loggers. He was winking at a lumberjack who had, to judge by the gape-mouthed look of surprise on his face, just picked the wrong nutshell. The drummer clown was taking a coin from him.
"Him again," Ben said.
"What, 100 years later?"
"Just about," Mike said.
"And here's one from 1891. It was a clipping from the front page of the Derry News. "Huzzah," the headline proclaimed exuberantly. "Ironworks opens." Just below this, "Town turns out for gala picnic." The picture showed a woodcut of the ribbon-cutting ceremony at the Kitchener Ironworks. Its style reminded Bill of the Currier and Ives prints his mother had in the dining room, although this was nowhere near as polished. A fellow tricked out in a morning coat and top hat was holding a large pair of open-jawed scissors above the ironworks ribbon, while a crowd of perhaps 500 watched. Off to the left was a clown, their clown, turning a handspring for a group of children. The artist had caught him upside down, turning his smile into a scream. He passed the book on quickly to Richie. The next picture was a photograph under which Will Hanlon had written, "1933, Repeal in Derry." Although none of the boys knew much about either the Volstead Act or its repeal, the picture made the salient facts clear. The photo was of Wally's Spa down in Hell's Half Acre. The place was almost literally filled to the rafters with men wearing open-collared white shirts, straw boaters, lumbermen's shirts, T-shirts, bankers' suits. All of them were holding glasses and bottles victoriously aloft. There were two big signs in the window. "Welcome back, John Barleycorn," one read. The other said, "Free beer tonight." The clown, dressed like the biggest dandy you ever saw, white shoes, spats, gangster pants, had his foot on the running board of a Rio auto and was drinking champagne from a lady's high-heeled shoe. 1945, Mike said. The Derry News again. The headline, "Japan surrenders. It's over. Thank God it's over." A parade was snake-dancing its way along Main Street toward Up Mile Hill. And there was the clown in the background, wearing his silver suit with the orange buttons, frozen in the matrix of dots that made up the grainy newsprint photo, seeming to suggest, at least to Bill, that nothing was over. No one had surrendered. Nothing was won. Nil was still the rule. Zilch still the custom, seeming to suggest above all that all was still lost. Bill felt cold and dry and scared. Suddenly, the dots in the picture disappeared, and it began to move.
"That's what..."
Mike began.
"Lilla, look," Bill said.
The word dropped out of his mouth like a partially melted ice cube.
All of you, look at this.
They crowded around.
"Oh, my God,"
Beverly whispered, awed.
"That's it,"
Richie nearly screamed, pounding Bill on the back in his excitement. He looked around at Eddie's white, drawn face and Stan Urus's frozen one.
"That's what we saw in George's room. That's exactly what we..."
"Shh," Ben said. "Listen."
And almost sobbing,
"You can hear them. Christ, you can hear them in there."
and in the silence that was only broken by the mild stir of the summer breeze, they all realized they could. The band was playing a martial marching tune, made faint and tinny by distance, or the passage of time, or whatever it was. The cheering of the crowd was like sounds that might come through on a badly tuned radio station. There were popping noises, also faint, like the muffled sound of snapping fingers.
"Firecrackers," Beverly whispered, and rubbed at her eyes with hands that shook. "Those are firecrackers, aren't they?"
No one answered. They watched the picture, their eyes eating up their faces. The parade wiggled its way toward them, but just before the marchers reached the extreme foreground, at the point where it seemed they must march right out of the picture and into a world 13 years later, they dropped from sight, as if on some kind of unknowable curve. The World War I soldiers first, their faces strangely old under their pie-plate helmets, with their sign which read, "The Derry VFW welcomes home our brave boys." Then the Boy Scouts, the Kiwanians, the Home Nursing Corps, the Derry Christian Marching Band. Then the Derry World War II vets themselves, with the high school band behind them. The crowd moved and shifted. Ticker tape and confetti fluttered down from the second and third floor windows of the business buildings that line the streets. The clown pranced along the sidelines, doing splits and cartwheels, miming a sniper, miming a salute. And Bill noticed for the first time that people were turning from him, but not as if they saw him, exactly. It was more as if they felt a draft or smelled something bad. Only the children really saw him, and they shrank away. Ben stretched his hand out to the picture, as Bill had done in George's room.
"No, no, no, no," Bill cried.
"I think it's all right, Bill," Ben said. "Look." And he laid his hand on the protective plastic over the picture for a moment and then took it back.
"But if you stripped off that cover..."
Beverly screamed. The clown had left off its antics when Ben withdrew his hand. It rushed toward them, its paint-bloody mouth gibbering and laughing. Bill winced back but held on to the book all the same, thinking it would drop out of sight as the parade had done, and the marching band, and the Boy Scouts, and the Cadillac convertible carrying Miss Derry of 1945. But the clown did not disappear along that curve that seemed to define the edge of that old existence. Instead, it leaped with a scary, nimble grace onto a lamppost that stood in the extreme left foreground of the picture. It shinnied up like a monkey on a stick, and suddenly its face was pressed against the tough plastic sheet Will Hanlon had put over each of the pages in his book. Beverly screamed again, and this time Eddie joined her, although his scream was faint and blue, breathless. The plastic bulged out. Later, they would all agree they saw it. Bill saw the bulb of the clown's red nose flatten, the way your nose will flatten when you press it against a window pane.
"Kill you all!"
The clown was laughing and screaming.
"Try to stop me, and I'll kill you all! Drive you crazy, and then kill you all! You can't stop me! I'm the gingerbread man! I'm the teenage werewolf!"
And for a moment, it was the teenage werewolf, the moon-silvered face of the lycanthrope peering out at them from over the collar of the silver suit, white teeth bared.
"Can't stop me, I'm the leper."
Now the leper's face, haunted and peeling, rotting with sores, stared at them with the eyes of the living dead.
"Can't stop me, I'm the mummy."
The leper's face aged and ran with sterile cracks. Ancient bandages swam halfway out of its skin and solidified there. Ben turned away, his face as white as curds, one hand plastered over his neck and ear.
"Can't stop me, I'm the dead boys."
"No," Stan Uris screamed. His eyes bulged above bruised-looking crescents of skin. Shock flesh, Bill thought randomly. And it was a word he would use in a novel 12 years later, with no idea where it had come from, simply taking it, as writers take the right word at the right time, as a simple gift from that outer space, other space, where the good words come from sometimes. Stan snatched the album from his hands and slammed it shut. He held it closed with both hands, the tendons standing out along the inner surfaces of his wrists and forearms. He looked around at the others with eyes that were nearly insane. "No," he said rapidly. "No, no, no." And suddenly Bill found he was more concerned with Stan's repeated denials than with the clown, and he understood that this was exactly the sort of reaction the clown had hoped to provoke, because
maybe it's scared of us, really scared for the first time in its long, long life.
He grabbed Stan and shook him twice, hard, holding onto his shoulders. Stan's teeth clicked together, and he dropped the album. Mike picked it up and put it aside in a hurry, not liking to touch it after what he had seen. But it was still his father's, and he understood intuitively that his father would never see in it what he had just seen.
No,
Stan said softly.
Yes,
Bill said.
No,
Stan said again.
Yes, we all... No, all saw it, Stan,
Bill said. He looked at the others.
Yes, Ben said.
Yes, Richie said.
Yes, Mike said. Oh, my God, yes.
Yes, Bev said.
Yes,
Eddie managed, gasping it out of his rapidly closing throat. Bill looked at Stan, demanding with his eyes that Stan look back at him.
Don't let it get you, you man,
Bill said.
You saw it, too.
I didn't want to,
Stan wailed. Sweat stood out on his brow in an oily sheen.
But you did.
Stan looked at the others one by one. He ran his hands through his short hair and fetched up a great shuddering sigh. His eyes seemed to clear of that lowering madness that had so disturbed Bill.
Yes, he said. Yes, okay, yes. That what you want?
Yes.
Bill thought, we're still all together. It didn't stop us. We can still kill it. We can still kill it, if we're brave.
Bill looked around at the others and saw in each pair of eyes some measure of Stan's hysteria. Not quite as bad, but there.
Yeah,
he said, and smiled at Stan. After a moment, Stan smiled back, and some of that horrible, shocked look left his face.
That's what I wanted, you wet end.
Beep, beep, Dumbo,
Stan said, and they all laughed. It was hysterical, screaming laughter, but better than no laughter at all, Bill reckoned.
Come on,
he said, because someone had to say something. Let's finish the clubhouse. What do you say? He saw the gratitude in their eyes and felt a measure of gladness for them. But their gratitude did little to heal his own horror. In fact, there was something in their gratitude which made him want to hate them. Would he never be able to express his own terror, lest the fragile welds that made them into one thing should let go? And even to think such a thing wasn't really fair, was it? Because in some measure, at least, he was using them, using his friends, risking their lives, to settle the score for his dead brother. And was even that the bottom? No, because George was dead, and if revenge could be exacted at all, Bill suspected it could only be exacted on behalf of the living. And what did that make him? A selfish little shit waving a tin sword and trying to make himself look like King Arthur? Oh, Christ, he groaned to himself. If this is the stuff adults have to think about, I never want to grow up. His resolve was still strong, but it was a bitter resolve. Bitter. Chapter 15. The Smoke Hole. 1. Richie Tozier pushes his glasses up on his nose. Already the gesture feels perfectly familiar, although he has worn contact lenses for 20 years. And thinks with some amazement that the atmosphere has changed in the room while Mike recalled the incident with the bird out at the ironworks and reminded them about his father's photograph album and the picture that had moved. Richie had felt a mad, exhilarating kind of energy growing in the room. He had done cocaine 9 or 10 times over the last couple of years, at parties mostly. Coke wasn't something you wanted just lying around your house if you were a big-a-time disc jockey. And the feel was something like that, but not exactly. This feeling was purer, more of a mainline high. He thought he recognized the feeling from his childhood when he had felt it every day and had come to take it merely as a matter of course. He supposed that if he had ever thought about that deep-running aquifer of energy as a kid, he could not recall that he ever had, he would have simply dismissed it as a fact of life. Something that would always be there, like the color of his eyes or his disgusting hammer toes. Well, that hadn't turned out to be true. The energy you drew on so extravagantly when you were a kid, the energy you thought would never exhaust itself, that slipped away somewhere between 18 and 24 to be replaced by something much duller, something as bogus as a coke high. Purpose, maybe, or goals, or whatever rah-rah junior chamber of commerce word you wanted to use. It was no big deal. It didn't go all at once with a bang. And maybe Richie thought that's the scary part. How you don't stop being a kid all at once with a big explosive bang,
like one of that clown's trick balloons with the Burma Shave slogans on the sides. The kid in you just leaked out like the air out of a tire. And one day you looked in the mirror and there was a grown-up looking back at you. You could go on wearing blue jeans. You could keep going to Springsteen and Seeger concerts. You could dye your hair. But that was a grown-up's face in the mirror just the same. It all happened while you were asleep, maybe, like a visit from the Tooth Fairy.
No,
he thinks. Not the Tooth Fairy. The Age Fairy. He laughs aloud at the stupid extravagance of this image, and when Beverly looks at him questioningly, he waves a hand at her. Nothing, babe, he says. Just thinking, methinks. But now that energy is back. No, not all the way back. Not yet, anyway, but coming back. And it's not just him. He can feel it filling the room. Mike looks okay to Richie for the first time since they all got together for that hideous lunch out by the mall. When Richie walked into the lobby and saw Mike sitting there with Ben and Eddie, he thought, shocked, there's a man who's going crazy, getting ready to commit suicide, maybe. But that look is gone now. Not just sublimated, gone. Richie has sat right here and watched the last of it slip out of Mike's face while he relived the experience of the bird and the album. He's been energized. And it is the same with all of them. It's in their faces, their voices, their gestures. Eddie pours himself another gin and prune juice. Bill knocks back some bourbon, and Mike cracks another beer. Beverly glances up at the balloons Bill has tethered to the microfilm recorder at the main desk and finishes her third screwdriver in a hurry. They have all been drinking pretty enthusiastically, but none of them are drunk. Richie doesn't know where that energy he feels is coming from, but it's not out of a liquor bottle. Dairy niggers get the bird. Blue. The losers are still losing, but Stanley Uris is finally ahead. Orange. Christ, Richie thinks, opening a fresh beer for himself. It isn't bad enough it can be any damn monster it wants to be, and it isn't bad enough that it can feed off our fears. It also turns out to be Rodney Dangerfield in drag. It's Eddie who breaks the silence. How much do you think it knows about what we're doing now? He asks. It was here, wasn't it? Ben says. I'm not sure that means much, Eddie replies. Bill nods. Those are just images, he says. I'm not sure that means it can see us or know what we're up to. You can see a news commentator on TV, but he can't see you. Those balloons aren't just images, Beverly says, and jerks a thumb over her shoulder at them. They're real. That's not true, though, Richie says, and they all look at him. Images are real. Sure they are. They... And suddenly something else clicks into place. Something new. It clicks into place with such firm force that he actually puts his hands to his ears. His eyes widen behind his glasses. Oh, my God, he cries suddenly. He gropes for the table, half stands, then falls back into his chair with a boneless thud. He knocks his can of beer over, reaching for it, picks it up, and drinks what's left. He looks at Mike while the others look at him, startled and concerned. The burning, he almost shouts. The burning in my eyes. Mike, the burning in my eyes. Mike is nodding, smiling a little. Richie? Bill asks. What is it? But Richie barely hears him. The force of the memory sweeps through him like a tide, turning him alternately hot and cold, and he suddenly understands why these memories have come back one at a time. If he had remembered everything at once, the force would have been like a psychological shotgun blast let off an inch from his temple. It would have torn off the whole top of his head. We saw it come, he says to Mike. We saw it come, didn't we? You and me. Or was it just me? He grabs Mike's hand, which lies on the table. Did you see it too, Mikey, or was it just me? Did you see it? The forest fire, the crater? I saw it, Mike says quietly, and squeezes Richie's hand. Richie closes his eyes for a moment, thinking he has never felt such a warm and powerful wave of relief in his life. Not even when the PSA jet he had taken from L.A. to San Francisco skidded off the runway and just stopped there. Nobody killed, nobody even hurt. Some luggage had fallen out of the overhead bins, and that was all. He had jumped onto the yellow emergency slide and had helped a woman away from the plane. The woman had turned her ankle on a hummock concealed in the high grass. She was laughing and saying, I can't believe I'm not dead. I can't believe it. I just can't believe it.
So Richie, who was half carrying the woman with one arm and waving with the other to the firemen who were making frantic come on gestures to the deplaning passengers, said,
"Okay, you're dead. You're dead. You feel better now?" And they both laughed crazily.
That had been relief laughter, but this relief is greater.
"What are you guys talking about?" Eddie asks, looking from one to the other.
Richie looks at Mike, but Mike shakes his head.
"You go ahead, Richie. I've had my say for the evening."
"The rest of you don't know, or maybe don't remember, because you left," Richie tells them. "Me and Mikey, we were the last two engines in the smoke hole."
"The smoke hole," Bill muses. His eyes are far and blue.
"The burning sensation in my eyes," Richie says, "under my contact lenses. I felt it for the first time right after Mike called me in California. I didn't know what it was then, but I do now. It was smoke. Smoke that was 27 years old.
He looks at Mike.
"Psychological, would you say? Psychosomatic? Something from the subconscious?"
"I would say not," Mike answers quietly. "I would say that what you felt was as real as those balloons, or the head I saw in the icebox, or the corpse of Tony Tracker that Eddie saw."
"Tell them, Richie."
Richie says, "It was 4 or 5 days after Mike brought his dad's album down to the Barrens, sometime just after the middle of July, I guess. The clubhouse was done, but the smoke hole thing, that was your idea, Haystack. You got it out of one of your books."
Smiling a little, Ben nods.
Richie thinks, "It was overcast that day, no breeze, thunder in the air. Like the day a month or so later when we stood in the stream and made a circle, and Stan cut our hands with that chunk of Coke bottle. The air was just sitting there, waiting for something to happen. And later Bill said that was why it got so bad in there so quick, because there was no draft."
July 17th. Yes, that was it. That had been the day of the smoke hole. July 17th, 1958. Almost a month after summer vacation began and the nucleus of the losers, Bill, Eddie, and Ben, had formed down in the Barrens.
"Let me look up the weather forecast for that day almost 27 years ago," Richie thinks. "And I'll tell you what it said before I even read it. Richard Tozier, a.k.a. the Great Mentalizer. Hot, humid chance of thundershowers, and watch out for the visions that may come while you're down in the smoke hole."
It had been 2 days after the body of Jimmy Cullum was discovered, the day after Mr. Nell had come down to the Barrens again and sat right on the clubhouse without knowing it was there, because by then they had capped it off, and Ben himself had carefully overseen the application of the tangle track and replacement of the sods. Unless you got right down on your hands and knees and crawled around, you'd have no idea anything was there. Like the dam, Ben's clubhouse had been a roaring success. But this time Mr. Nell didn't know anything about it. He had questioned them carefully, officially, taking down their answers in his black notebook. But there had been little they could tell him, at least about Jimmy Cullum. And Mr. Nell had gone away again after reminding them once more that they were not to play in the Barrens alone, ever. Richie guessed that Mr. Nell would have told them simply to get out if anyone in the Derry Police Department had really believed that the Cullum boy, or any of the others, had actually been killed in the Barrens. But they knew better. Because of the sewer and storm drain system, that was simply where the remains tended to finish up. Mr. Nell had come on the 16th, yes, a hot and humid day also, but sunny. The 17th had been overcast.
"Are you going to talk to us or not, Richie?" Bev asks.
She is smiling a little, her lips full and a pale rose red, her eyes alight.
"I'm just thinking about where to start," Richie says. He takes his glasses off, wipes them on his shirt, and suddenly he knows where.
With the ground opening up at his and Bill's feet. Of course, he knew about the clubhouse, so did Bill and the rest of them. But it still freaked him out, seeing the ground suddenly open on a slit of darkness like that. He remembers Bill riding him double on the back of Silver to the usual place on Kansas Street, and then stowing his bike under the little bridge. He remembers the two of them walking along the path toward the clearing, sometimes having to turn sideways because the brush was so thick. It was midsummer now, and the Barrens were at that year's apogee of lushness. He remembers swatting at the mosquitoes that hummed maddeningly close to their ears. He even remembers Bill saying, "Oh, how clearly it all comes back. Not as if it happened yesterday, but as if it is happening now."
"Ha-ha, hold it, a-s-s-s-"
Two.
Eckened Ritchie. There's a damn gaga hoodwin on the back of your neck.
Oh, Christ, Ritchie said.
He hated mosquitoes. Little flying vampires, that's all they were when you got right down to the facts.
Kill it, Big Bill.
Bill swatted the back of Ritchie's neck.
Ouch!
See? Bill held his hand in front of Ritchie's face. There was a broken mosquito body in the center of an irregular patch of blood.
My blood,
Ritchie thought,
which was shed for you and for many.
Yuck, he said.
The don't worry, Bill said. Little fucker will never dance the tango again.
They walked on, slapping at mosquitoes, waving at the clouds of no-see-ums attracted by something in the smell of their sweat, something which would years later be identified as pheromones, whatever they were.
Bill, when are you going to tell the rest of them about the silver bullets?
Ritchie asked as they approached the clearing. In this case, the rest of them meant Bev, Eddie, Mike, and Stan, although Ritchie guessed Stan already had a good idea of what they were studying up on down at the public library. Stan was sharp. Too sharp for his own good, Ritchie sometimes thought. The day Mike brought his father's album down to the Barrens, Stan had almost flipped out. Ritchie had, in fact, been nearly convinced that they wouldn't see Stan again and the Losers Club would become a sextet. A word Ritchie liked a lot, always with the emphasis on the first syllable. But Stan had been back the next day, and Ritchie had respected him all the more for that.
You going to tell them today?
Not today, Bill said. You don't think they'll work, do you? Bill shrugged, and Ritchie, who maybe understood Bill Denbro better than anyone ever would until Audra Phillips, suspected all the things Bill might have said if not for the roadblock of his speech impediment. That kids making silver bullets was boys' book stuff, comic book stuff. In a word, it was crap. Dangerous crap. They could try it, yeah. Ben Hanscom might even be able to bring it off, yeah. In a movie, it would work, yeah. But... So?
I got an idea,
Bill said.
Simpler. But only if Beverly...
If Beverly what?
Never mind.
And Bill would say no more on the subject. They came into the clearing. If you looked closely, you might have thought that the grass there had a slightly matted look, a slightly used look. You might even have thought that there was something a bit artificial, almost arranged, about the scatter of leaves and pine needles on top of the sods. Bill picked up a ring-ding wrapper, Ben's almost certainly, and put it absently in his pocket. The boys crossed to the center of the clearing, and a piece of ground about 10 inches long by 3 inches wide swung up with a dirty squall of hinges, revealing a black eyelid. Eyes looked out of that blackness, giving Ritchie a momentary chill. But they were only Eddie Kasprak's eyes, and it was Eddie, whom he would visit in the hospital a week later, who intoned hollowly,
"Who's that trip-trapping on my bridge?"
Giggles from below, and a flashlight flicker.
"This is the rurale, senor,"
Ritchie said, squatting down, twirling an invisible mustache, and speaking in his poncho vanilla voice.
"Yeah?" Beverly asked from below. "Let's see your badges."
"Batches?" Ritchie cried delightedly. "We don't need no stinkin' batches."
"Go to hell, Poncho,"
Eddie replied and slammed the big eyelid closed. There were more muffled giggles from below.
"Come out with your hands up,"
Bill cried in a low, commanding adult voice. He began to tramp back and forth across the sod-covered cap of the clubhouse. He could see the ground springing up and down with his back and forth passage, but just barely. They had built well.
"You haven't got a chance," he bellowed, seeing himself as fearless Joe Friday of the LAPD in his mind's eye. "Come on out of there, punks, or we'll come in shooting."
He jumped up and down once to emphasize his point. Screams and giggles from below. Bill was smiling, unaware that Ritchie was looking at him wisely, looking at him not as one child looks at another, but in that brief moment as an adult looks at a child.
"He doesn't know that he doesn't always," Ritchie thought. "Let them in, Ben, before they crash the roof in,"
Bev said. A moment later, a trap door flopped open like the hatch on a submarine. Ben looked out. He was flushed. Ritchie knew at once that Ben had been sitting next to Beverly. Bill and Ritchie dropped down through the hatch, and Ben closed it again. Then there they all were, sitting snug against board walls with their legs drawn up, their faces dimly revealed in the beam of Ben's flashlight.
"So what's going on?" Bill asked.
"Not too much," Ben said. He was indeed sitting next to Beverly, and his face looked happy as well as flushed. "We were just..."
"Tell him, Ben,"
Eddie interrupted. Tell them the story. See what they think.
Wouldn't do much for your asthma, Stan told Eddie in his best someone-has-to-be-practical-here tone of voice.
Richie sat between Mike and Ben, holding his knees in his linked hands. It was delightfully cool down here, delightfully secret. Following the gleam of the flashlight as it moved from face to face, he temporarily forgot what had so astounded him outside only a minute ago.
What are you talking about?
Oh, Ben was telling us a story about this Indian ceremony, Bev said. But Stan's right. It wouldn't be very good for your asthma, Eddie.
It might not bother it, Eddie said, sounding, to his credit, Richie thought, only a little uneasy.
Usually it's only when I get upset. Anyway, I'd like to try it.
Try what? Bill asked him.
The smoke hole ceremony, Eddie said.
Well, what's that?
The beam of Ben's flashlight drifted upward, and Richie followed it with his eyes. It tracked aimlessly across the wooden roof of their clubhouse, as Ben explained. It crossed the gouged and splintered panels of the mahogany door the seven of them had carried back here from the dump 3 days ago, the day before the body of Jimmy Cullum was discovered. The thing Richie remembered about Jimmy Cullum, a quiet little boy who also wore spectacles, was that he liked to play Scrabble on rainy days.
Not going to be playing Scrabble anymore, Richie thought, and shivered a little. In the dimness, no one saw the shiver, but Mike Hanlon, sitting shoulder to shoulder with him, glanced at him curiously.
Well, I got this book out of the library last week, Ben was saying. Ghosts of the Great Plains, it's called. And it's all about the Indian tribes that lived out west 150 years ago. The Paiutes and the Pawnees and the Kiowas and the Otoes and the Comanches. It was really a good book. I'd love to go out there sometime where they lived. Iowa, Nebraska, Colorado, Utah.
Shut up and tell about the smoke hole ceremony, Beverly said, elbowing him.
Sure, he said, right. And Richie believed his response would have been the same if Beverly had given him the elbow and said, drink the poison now, Ben, okay?
See, almost all those Indians had a special ceremony, and our clubhouse made me think of it. Whenever they had to make a big decision, whether to move on after the buffalo herds, or to find fresh water, or whether or not to fight their enemies, they'd dig a big hole in the ground and cover it up with branches, except for a little vent in the top.
The smoke hole, Bill said.
Your quick mind never ceases to amaze me, Big Bill, Richie said gravely. You ought to go on 21. I'll bet you could even beat old Charlie Van Doren.
Bill made as if to hit him, and Richie recoiled, bumping his head a pretty good one on a piece of shoring.
Ouch! You deserved it, Bill said.
I kill you, rotten gringo sumbeesh, Richie said. We don't need no stinking...
Will you guys stop it? Beverly asked. This is interesting.
And she favored Ben with such a warm look that Richie believed steam would start curling out of Haystack's ears in a couple of minutes.
Okay, Ben, Bill said. Go on.
Sure,
Ben said. The word came out in a croak. He had to clear his throat and start again. When the smoke hole was finished, they'd start a fire down there. They'd use green wood so it would be a really smoky fire. Then all the braves would go down there and sit around the fire. The place would fill up with smoke. The book said this was a religious ceremony, but it was also kind of a contest, you know? After half a day or so, most of the braves would bug out because they couldn't stand the smoke anymore, and only two or three would be left, and they were supposed to have visions. End of side 19.